ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 22nd of January. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. The Coalition is in chaos after a Nationals exodus from the front bench, raising the possibility of a second split in less than a year. Yesterday, three Nationals senators were dumped from the shadow cabinet after breaking ranks and voting against the government's new hate laws. Hours later, party leader David Littleproud and seven other Nats followed in solidarity. For more on this, we spoke to our political reporter, Evelyn Manfield, in Parliament House. Evelyn, talk us through this extraordinary move.
Well, Isabella, as the saying goes, 24 hours is a long time in politics, and the last 24 hours has definitely shown us that. All National members have quit the front bench, including the leader of the party, David Littleproud. So what started as three senators yesterday who got booted from the front bench because they didn't follow the rule of shadow cabinet solidarity, which is where you have to vote with the decision that shadow cabinet made. They didn't do that. They opposed the government's hate speech laws, despite this deal being done between the government and the Liberal Party. But what actually happened before they crossed the floor is that the Nationals Party as a whole decided that they were going to oppose that piece of legislation. So what's unfolded in the last 24 hours is the rest of the Nationals' front benches have quit in solidarity. Now, the latest is we've received a statement from Susan Lee, the leader of the Liberal Party and the opposition. She says she's deemed the offers of resignation, these latest ones, so not the first three senators, unnecessary. She says no permanent changes will be made to the shadow ministry at this time to give the Nationals time to reconsider these offers of resignations. So this morning, that leaves lots of questions in the air.
I guess the big question is, what does this mean for the future of the coalition at this stage?
That sure is the big question. Yeah, it appears really fragile, and not for the first time. It's worth reminding everyone that within this term of parliament, so last year, not long after the election, the coalition did break up. Of course, they did get back together not that far later, but it's obviously been a tense time this term of parliament for the coalition. Now, Susan Lee says she has strongly urged David Littleproud not to walk away from the coalition. She says as well she received a letter from the Nationals leader and he did not indicate that the Nationals are leaving the coalition. So she's definitely hoping to maintain this coalition of the Nationals and Liberals. But nonetheless, this moment is a big blow to the trust between the two parties because, as I was saying, they agreed to something in shadow cabinet and that's not what the Nats followed through with.
And Evelyn, this was all happening late at night, not too much reaction around yet, but we'll be waiting to see how the government, One Nation, other parties respond as the day develops. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Evelyn Manfield reporting from Parliament House. A minute's silence will be held across the country tonight in honour of the 15 lives lost in the Bondi attack. The Chabad Jewish community of Bondi will hold a special event in Sydney to mark the National Day of Mourning. Across the country, there'll be services, light installations and flags flown at half-mast in remembrance of Australia's deadliest terror attack. Isabel Misali reports.
Sydney lifeguard Jackson Doolan was about 15 minutes from finishing his shift at Bronte Beach when he says he heard the gunshots coming from nearby Bondi.
I had no shoes on, and which was fine to me. I'm from Queensland, so a lot of us get around in barefoot up there. But yeah, I grabbed the defibrillator and I didn't even think, to be honest. I just knew I needed to help.
A photo captured of this sprint later went viral.
It was a bit of a surreal moment, you know, running down and seeing people running the other way. And I was, yeah, just charging to help out my colleagues.
He was one of the first people on scene treating the victims. One of them stands out in his memory, 14-year-old Kaya, who had been shot in the leg.
I was just saying, you're going to get through this. And luckily for her, you know, she did. And so thankful. But, you know, there was obviously some that weren't as lucky.
Jackson Doolan is one of many people whose life is forever changed by the attack on the 14th of December. Today, a National Day of Mourning will honour the 15 victims who lost their lives. The theme is Light Will Win, a gathering of unity and remembrance.
I think for me, it will really be a day of reflection and pause.
That's Simone Abel from the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, who will be visiting Bondi today. She says it's been encouraging to see the government respond with a Royal Commission and legal reform, though she's disappointed new federal hate speech laws were not supported by all, including the Nationals.
But, you know, we got there in the end and there's still work to be done. Unfortunately, the serious vilification offence for promotion of hatred was not passed, but there were a lot of important changes that were supported.
She also hopes the Royal Commission will deliver practical recommendations. For now, she's cautiously optimistic about the future.
I have a lot of faith in our common decency and humanity, and I think we really saw that on the 14th of December. You know, on one hand, we saw the absolute worst thing we could imagine, but on the other hand, we saw such an outpouring of love and courage.
Courage displayed by first responders like Jackson Doolan.
I know that we won't be defined by this, and I think with time, the Bondi community can get through it together. When we struggle, someone picks you up. It's just the way things work down here.
Lifeguard Jackson Doolan ending that report by Isabel Misali and Pablo Vinales. Donald Trump says the framework of a future deal on Greenland has been reached after a meeting with NATO leaders. Details are scarce, but the US president has also walked back his threat to impose tariffs on European nations who opposed his takeover of the territory. It comes after he spoke at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, promising he wouldn't use military force. For more on this, I spoke to our America's editor, John Lyons. John, tell us, what did Mr. Trump have to say this time about Greenland?
Well, Isabella, he did rule out any military action, which I think was something of relief to those in the room. However, he did lay out a case for why the United States should have Greenland. And so while there was a certain relief, I think that it's clear that this story's not over. And Donald Trump at the moment knows he's at the height of his power. He knows that when the midterm elections happen here in the United States later this year in November, that his power may be clipped and that he's therefore keen, while he's at the height of his power, to try to do whatever he wants to do. He believes that Greenland is part of, he says, our hemisphere, is the phrase he uses, and he says, therefore, the Americans should own it, not have any sort of lease on it.
Well, let's take a listen to what President Trump had to say.
We never asked for anything, and we never got anything. We probably won't get anything unless I decide to use excessive strength and force, where we would be, frankly, unstoppable. But I won't do that, okay? Now everyone's saying, oh, good. That's probably the biggest statement I made, because people thought I would use force. I don't have to use force. I don't want to use force. I won't use force.
John, some interesting language there. Where do you think this all goes to now?
Well, Donald Trump was today talking still like the old property developer that he is, and he started talking about all we're asking for is Greenland, including the right title and ownership. And he said, because you need the ownership of something to defend it. You can't defend something on a lease. He said, number one, legally, that's not defensible. And number two, psychologically, to quote him, who the hell wants to defend a license agreement or a lease? He also said that he wants to begin immediately negotiations to acquire Greenland. And so I think the cooler heads in the administration, such as Secretary of State Marco Rubio, have been successfully pushing the option of a purchase of Greenland rather than a military takeover.
And John, as you say, promising not to use force, but still some pretty heated language there. What's the reaction been in Europe?
Well, I think in a way, the fascinating thing is why Donald Trump felt the need to so declaratively say that force was off the table. I think it's because he's felt the pressure of people such as Emmanuel Macron from France, Mark Carney from Canada have been very strong, saying essentially this is overturning rule of law. This becomes the law of a brutal world that we would be moving into. Also, the European Parliament has formally suspended the ratification process on the US-EU trade deal, which is worth a lot of money to the United States. So I think Donald Trump actually felt that pressure from Europe and has responded partly.
Our America's editor, John Lyons, thanks for your insights.
Thanks, Isabella.
A visibly emotional Prince Harry has told the London court the British press made his wife's life a misery as he gave evidence in the case against the publisher of the tabloid, The Daily Mail. The Duke of Sussex and six other high-profile figures, including Elton John and Liz Hurley, alleged the newspaper illegally spied on them, gathering personal information it then published. Europe correspondent Elias Kluwer reports from London.
Prince Harry arriving at the Royal Courts of Justice in London. He's waited 3 years for his case against the publishers of the Daily Mail to get to trial. Now he can tell his story. The Duke of Sussex, along with six other famous faces, including Liz Hurley and Elton John, are suing the Mail, alleging the paper hired private investigators who used illegal spy tactics, including phone tapping, to gather sensitive information, which was then splashed across the tabloid's pages. Afua Hagen is a royal commentator who's been following the case.
I think Prince Harry views the tabloid press in the United Kingdom with utter contempt. I think he doesn't think that the tabloid press is really worth the paper that they're printed on, that journalists use these means to gather stories, and that they are always out to get him.
In court today, Harry told of his long-held mistrust of the British press and how he was instructed to never speak out about it.
He felt that he couldn't speak out because of the institution. They are forced to put up and shut up, basically, because they are so privileged. Never complain, never explain.
The prince, who now lives in California, then referenced several articles that he says contained information so personal it could have only been obtained through illegal surveillance. Then Harry became emotional, discussing his wife, Meghan Markle, telling the court the press made her life a misery.
When you look back over the tabloid stories that were written about Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, when she first started dating Prince Harry, when they were engaged, even after they were married, I mean, a lot of them had misogynistic, racist, sexist overtones.
The Daily Mail has always denied the allegations. It had a culture of using illegally gathered information and questioned Harry over whether his friends could have been the source of the stories, something the Duke rejected. The case against the Mail's publisher has faced multiple issues. Key witnesses against the paper have retracted or changed statements. The Duke has been a key driver of this case and reportedly helped recruit claimants, including the mother of murder victim Stephen Lawrence. Prince Harry has sued and won lawsuits against British tabloids before, but unlike previous cases against the British press, no journalists have confessed and police haven't been called to give evidence. Daily Mail says Harry's allegations are preposterous.
Harry! Harry! Harry!
There's a long way to go in this case and the stakes are high. Not only is the Daily Mail on trial, so is the Prince's judgment. This is Elias Kluwer in London, reporting for AM.
Exploited and treated deplorably. That's how a coroner has described the final weeks of a young man's life in Australia. The 21-year-old came from the Philippines on a training visa hoping to transform his life. But weeks later, he died on the job. Questions are now being raised about the safety of others working in similar conditions. Miles Holbrook-Walk reports.
Jessa Royapa remembers teaching her youngest brother guitar.
Among our siblings, me and Jerwin were musically inclined. We sing together.
Her brother Jerwin Royapa left the Philippines 7 years ago, headed for a New South Wales winery with a 407 visa for structured workplace training.
He's very excited and hopeful, not to just gain knowledge, but also to be able to help our parents.
Jerwin Royapa died 5 weeks later. The New South Wales Deputy Coroner Rebecca Hosking found Jerwin Royapa was exploited, working 60 hours a week in excessive heat, performing manual labour, and not receiving the training or allowance he was promised, without access to his passport and fearful of his sponsor. Deputy Coroner Hosking determined Jerwin Royapa voluntarily jumped or fell from a moving vehicle driven by his sponsor, also known as Operator One. He had blunt force injuries and died the next day.
It's very painful what happened to him. I promise him to give justice.
Legal aid solicitor Shiza Nas represented the Royapa family.
So the coroner has described Operator One's conduct after Joanne exited the vehicle as deplorable. And she makes this conclusion because Operator 1 did not render assistance through an ambulance immediately after Joanne exited the vehicle. He had also left the scene after explicitly being advised not to do so.
The Deputy Coroner's recommendations include the Home Affairs Department thoroughly review Joanne's death and exploitation risks for 407 visa holders. The Deputy Coroner also recommended Joanne Royaper's death be referred to Australian Federal Police. The National Anti-Slavery Commissioner, Chris Evans, has written to the Home Affairs Department and the Minister, Tony Burke, calling for 407 visa reform.
There's a range of other fundamental aspects of the visa that need to be changed, and they are driving the vulnerability to forced labour and modern slavery that exists inside that visa class.
In a statement, the Home Affairs Department said it's urgently considering the coroner's report and that since Joanne Royaper's death, improvements have been made, with the government planning to bring in new regulations targeting visa sponsors due this year.
And you can see more on that story from Miles Holbrook-Walk and Emily Jane Smith tonight on 7:30. The Tasmanian Aboriginal community has spent decades painstakingly reconstructing the island's Palawakani language. The work has now fed into the development of a mobile phone app, allowing users to learn the original names of hundreds of locations around Tasmania, known as Lutruwita in the local language. It's hoped non-Indigenous users will start embracing these traditional names. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Since the early 1990s, Tasmanian Aboriginal people have been piecing together the Palawakani language, relying on historical records, audio recordings and cultural knowledge. It's been reconstructed by combining elements from multiple original Tasmanian languages. Daisy Allen is a Palawakani language worker at the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre.
Because of the hard work that went into the revival of our language, the community is still very protective of it as it's our cultural gem. So not all Palawakani is available outside of the community. But in saying that, the community decided that it was very important that non-Aboriginal people could also embrace Tasmanian Aboriginal language by using the place names.
The Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre has now published a mobile phone app containing more than 300 place names across Lutruwita, which is the Palawakani name for Tasmania. Users can navigate a map or search a specific location for details, including pronunciation guides. Among them,
Nipaluna
for Hobart,
Kanamaluka
or Tamar River,
Kaparati,
now known as Adventure Bay on Bruny Island, and
Woolly Nantikala
for Cradle Mountain. There's also advice on wording for acknowledgements of country. For example, Daisy Allen explains the original name for Launceston has been lost, so it's best to refer to Kanamaluka, the nearby Tamar River.
So this app is one of the ways where we're putting languages, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages, back in centre focus and back on the agenda.
The app was developed by Tasmanian company Ionata Digital. Its chief executive is Martin Anderson.
Yeah, I think you can see there's a great deal of interest in the community to understand a bit more about the history of where we all live.
The app is designed to be useful in the Tasmanian wilderness too.
It's got an amazing offline map capability so that if you're not connected to the internet, all of those place names will be there and you can look up, you know, the Palawakani names of the area that you're in.
Strengthening Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages is a closing the gap target. Daisy Allen from the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre believes projects like this one are a crucial part of keeping languages alive.
When you can make these resources available to everybody, at the ease of just people going on their apps and their devices, it's promoting Aboriginal language.
Daisy Allen from the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre, ending that report from Alexandra Humphreys. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Today, on this National Day of Mourning, we speak to Jessica Chapnick-Khan, who was at Bondi during the December terrorist attack. She'd been at the petting zoo with her daughter. And we speak to the commissioning editor of the Jewish Independent about what's unfolded in the aftermath of the tragedy. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.